The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, Q&A edition. We've got a kind of a mixed up show today in that we're going to dive into some non-Social Security questions first, then back to Social Security at the end. That's just due to some scheduling issues that I'm sure Jim will share with you here momentarily. So we do want to thank everybody for tuning in once again. Not that you really tune into a podcast, but you get the gist. Most everyone listening to this podcast knows what tuning in means. My 14-year-old has no idea what tuning in anything means, since she's never, I think, ever touched an analog radio of any type or a television with a dial on it. So sad state of affairs, I guess, or probably not. Just makes me feel old. So Jim, thanks for joining me today. I know you've got a slew of questions for us, and I've already warned everyone that we're going to do Social Security at the end. That's because you need to take off. So I'll close out the show with one or more Social Security questions, but I'm glad you could join me for the beginning part.
Yeah, just doing the show a little backwards today, folks. Yours truly has a doctor's appointment. Got to do a few tests because of my AFib, so... Apparently, because of the drugs I'm on, Chris, they want to do tests every 6 months now. Mm. And this is my 6 months since my last test. So anyways, folks, that's all it is. Nothing major, but it is going to force me to leave. So we thought we would start with regular questions and then I can cut out towards the end of the show, if you will. And Chris will wrap up with his one or two Social Security questions rather than leading with Social Security questions. So,
perfect.
Just doing a little bit bass-ackwards today, no big deal. But other than that, everything here is fine, folks. Hopefully everything's fine with you. Can't believe it's already August. Summer's coming to an end. I'd say another 5-6 weeks. And
well, it feels this week here like summer has come to an end.
Yes. I loved this week's weather. At least here. I know there's some parts of the country that didn't have such great weather.
No.
But it was rather cool, cloudy, which is rare for Colorado, cool and cloudy. And I actually had a rainstorm. It lasted about 20 minutes. That's all I had. They were predicting all this rain was coming. It didn't really hit my area. But I did get 20 minutes of rain that was just insane. And big bursts of wind as well. It's like this little mini tornado hit me. Now, no tornado hit me, but it was just windy, rainy. And the bad news, I'm going somewhere with this, folks. My damn corn all blew down. It looks like someone took a bowling ball and rolled it through my corn.
That's too bad.
And I was only about 3 weeks away from harvest. So I have no idea if corn, which is now laying on the ground, will continue to ripen on the corn stalk. So I'm going to leave it. Keep watering it and see if it ripens. But it was just the most bizarre thing. The corn is just decimated. Yeah. It's like the wind got in there.
And it wasn't in the shape of a circle or some strange
shape. No, it wasn't crop writing or anything like that. Okay. It definitely was from some
Wasn't a UFO that landed.
Was it? It was four rows of corn crisps, six feet long. It's a small little patch. I'm feeding myself. I'm not feeding the world.
Yeah, the aliens would have trouble making any type of a say shape out of four rows of corn.
They would not have succeeded in creating anything. It's just the wind just nailed it and took it out. But everything else is okay, fortunately. One of the trials and tribulations of being a gardener is things like that happen, and you just got to deal with it. Yep. But I do have a second crop of corn. I always plant two crops. So the second crop is just about a foot high. And I guess it was so short, the wind didn't bother that. And that's still there. So it is possible, because I always try for that late September harvest of corn, which we can actually pull off in Colorado, folks, if September cooperates.
Yeah.
And sometimes it doesn't. A couple of years ago, it didn't. When we got, it was right at the beginning of September, just before, just after Labor Day. Remember, we had 2 days where it got below 20?
Cold. Yeah.
And then for the rest of September and into October, folks, 80s. It was just nuts. It just enough to kill everything I had at the beginning of September, and then beautiful weather through September and October. So assuming September doesn't do something like that, I should be harvesting my second crop of corn towards the end of September, and hopefully we'll have no windstorms that take that out.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to begin with, we got the new question of the week, as we like to do. But we have a couple of observations that people made about some recent shows. One is a mistake Chris made when he didn't pick up on something I said. But that's okay. Chris doesn't mind when people point that out. Do you, Chris?
No, I welcome it.
I know you do. So we'll start with the first thing where Chris forgot to correct me, which was a test. It wasn't a correction that needed. It was a test that Chris woefully failed. And as always, he began at "Hey, Jim," instead of "Hey, Chris." He just forgot that part. But he said, "Hey, Jim, this is George in Texas." Fake name, folks, by the way. He says, "On a recent show, you referred to exchanging multi-year guaranteed annuities when they mature through a 1031 exchange in order to defer taxes. But I believe the tax code is actually a 1035 exchange." And I was testing you, Chris. I don't know how you let that one slip through.
You know what? Honestly, I did hear that. And I didn't want to interrupt you right at that very second. And by the time you were done saying whatever you were saying, I did forget. Because now that he brought that up, I did remember that my ear hearing that and intending to fix it. But I will take the blame. I did not.
Well, you know, see, I test Chris all the time. It looks like I made the mistake, but all jokes aside, I always get those two messed up. I don't know why. I can remember the weirdest things, but I can never remember that the 1035 is the annuity, the 1031 is real estate. It's the bizarrest thing. But anyways, folks, this gentleman from Texas is correct, and it is a 1031 for doing real estate, a 1035 for moving one annuity to another without the imposition of any taxes during that movement. And keep in mind, as far as the annuity goes, it's for what we call, or what the industry calls, a non-qualified annuity. That's annuity that is not contained inside an IRA or other type of tax-qualified retirement account. So the industry calls them non-qualified. So you can move those annuities with that 1035 exchange. IRA annuities, you don't really have that problem, folks. You don't have to move them as a 1035, because when an annuity is held inside an IRA, the rules of an IRA apply, not the rules of an annuity. So if you're going to move from one annuity company to another annuity at a different company, or even the same company, just a different annuity, if it's in an IRA, you simply have the insurance company, assuming your penalty period has passed, you have the insurance company close and liquidate that annuity, keep it in the IRA, and you would just move the IRA as a transfer or a rollover into a new IRA that holds a new annuity. So do keep that in mind. If you're moving a qualified annuity, that's again an annuity inside an IRA or other qualified retirement account, you do not have to do a 1035 exchange. Anyways, just wanted to clarify that as well.
Nice.
Okay, so that was one observation. The next observation, I've got to give this guy credit because he definitely followed the KISS principle. Keep it simple, stupid. And what he pointed out was so obvious, I'm surprised it's never dawned on me or you in the past. Remember we addressed last week a question from someone who had a CRD, charitable, qualified, I always say CRD, QCD, yeah, not a QCD.
No, a CRD,
help me out
here. Coronavirus-related distribution. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. A coronavirus-related distribution, CRD. We had a question last week on them where the person wanted to know, instead of repaying the money to an IRA, can he repay it to a Roth IRA, not deduct it on his taxes, which he would be allowed to do if he paid it to an IRA, just put it in a Roth, not deduct it, so he's going to be putting after-tax dollars in, can he repay it to a Roth? And we explained that there's nothing in the law that we can see and other professionals who've reviewed it has seen that prevent you from doing it. But it does, as we said, and as Ed Slott said, violates the spirit of the law, and wonders, would the IRS ever go after them in the future? But they've never said not. And you pointed out, Chris, I think, if they didn't like it, they probably would have said something by now.
Yeah.
But this guy writes to us and he points out the obvious. Hey, Jim and Chris, I just finished your show today on the Q&A from July 24th. One question was whether people can contribute their CRDs. And remember, that's coronavirus-related distribution, folks. Their CRDs that were taken from an IRA back into a Roth. And then he continues, I actually have a cleaner idea for that. People can recontribute the CRD to their IRA and then just turn around and immediately convert it to a Roth. Am I right? And I kept thinking, is he right? Is he right? Is he right? Yes. Yeah. I can't see any reason why you couldn't do that.
Well, it's a two-step operation instead of, so as far as keeping it simple, it's a little more involved, being two steps, but
it removes the risk that the IRS, right?
Yeah. So I'm not sure it's a simplifying measure, but it's a fairly simple way of completely avoiding the issue we were talking about, which is them disallowing a direct recontribution into the Roth.
Right, but the question from last week, the person was asking is, can I do this? Well, and our answer was, we don't know. There's nothing saying you can, but there's nothing saying you can.
You definitely could do it this listener's proposed way.
Exactly. Yes.
Exactly.
Good point. The listener was spot on. Yep. If you're unsure and you're worried that the IRS will come back later and say, hey, you are violating the spirit of the law, you can't put that CRD back into a Roth. If you're worried about that, as this listener said, and he's correct, pay it back to the IRA, which is the spirit of the law. The law was you're going to put it back into the IRA within 3 years of taking it. So put it back into the IRA. And then if you want the money into a Roth, just turn around and convert it. Mm-hmm. The tax implications are the same. You're going to get a deduction as the money goes into the IRA, and then you'll have taxable income as the money goes into the Roth. Yeah. So it's...
I like it.
To me, yeah, it was an easy step to just get around.
A possible concern.
Sure. Yeah. Correct. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, nice.
Okay, we're going to get into the question of the week now. It's a very short question. It's from a gentleman in New Jersey. We're going to call him George. And he writes to us, Chris. He says, my wife inherited her mom's IRA in 2020. So let's pause there, folks. This is a post-Secure Act inherited IRA.
Right.
Non-spouse. It's the daughter inherited the mother's. Okay. So my wife inherited her mom's IRA in 2020. Thanks to the new IRS guidelines, she is required to take annual required minimum distributions. She did not take one in 2021. Should she take the 2021 RMD now and file form 5329? So let's pause there. Let me explain what this guy is saying, folks. So we can extrapolate a lot from what he's saying. His wife inherited an IRA from her mom. The IRS came out this year and said, if you inherited an IRA post-Secure Act, which would be after January 1st of 2020, and this gentleman's wife did, if you inherit an IRA post-Secure Act, here are the proposed rules we're going to want you to follow. These are not codified rules. They're proposed rules to indicate the way the IRS is thinking they are going to rule inherited IRAs be treated. And one of the things they said was if you inherited an IRA from a non-spouse, and this is clearly a non-spouse, it was inherited from her mom, and the decedent is older than their required beginning date, which for simplicity's sake is April 1st of the year following the year the IRA owner turned 72. If you died after the required beginning date, the owner of the IRA died after their required beginning date, the person who inherited it must take required minimum distributions based on their single life table for the first 9 years of having that inherited IRA. And in year 10, the rest of that IRA must be closed. That is the minimum. You can always take out dollars greater than that, but that's the minimum. So far, so good, Chris. Got any comments? Yep.
Nope. So far, so good.
Okay. So then he's asking or stating the wife never took required minimum distributions yet. And there's a good reason she never did, folks. The proposed regulations didn't come out until 2022. She inherited the IRA in 2020. Back then, the thinking was the IRS would treat this 10-year rule the way they treat the 5-year rule, where they say you don't have to take anything out during years 1 to 4. Just make sure the whole IRA is closed in year 5. If you want to take anything out from year 1 to 4, it's up to you. So we thought those rules would apply to the new 10-year rule, that if you inherited an IRA post-secure from a non-spouse, hey, for the first 9 years, take it out if you want, leave it in if you want, doesn't matter. But in year 10, anything that's in there must be taken out. So that's why she never took any money out in 20 and 21. But I'll also argue she didn't take anything out in 2020 because RMDs were abolished in 2020, including for inherited IRAs because of COVID.
Yeah, so she doesn't have to worry about 20.
Correct. When COVID first hit, they were passing every rule that they could think of to try to help people. And one of them was, hey, we're going to get rid of RMDs for a year. She didn't take out any money in 2021 because the proposed regulations did not exist. Now we have the proposed regulations. And here's the conundrum, Chris, and listeners in general. Do you still follow proposed regulations or wait for the final regulations. The final regulations could be dramatically different than the proposed. There's no guarantee what the IRS is proposing will see the light of day. There's a strong probability, but no guarantee. So do you ignore them until the final regulations come out? Or do you follow them as a best practice because the likelihood of the IRS codifying them into the final rules is very, very strong? Ed Slott takes the latter. He said you should start following the proposed regulations because it's the best we have, and it gives us an idea of what the IRS is going to require. But he also says he doesn't see the IRS coming out and being mean, for lack of a better way to word it.
I think they'd have a hard time penalizing you for not doing something that they didn't tell you you needed to do until after it was too late to do it, which means, you know, a year after.
Right. So I think here's my take of what your wife might want to consider, listener, and that and a nickel won't even get you a cup of tea in China. So you can take what I'm sharing, Chris can share his thoughts, and then you and your wife can decide. In 2021, there were no proposed regulations, no rules, no hint, no anything from the IRS that they wanted RMDs taken. I don't think she has to take the 2021 RMD. It's not to say the IRS won't force it, but if they do want the 2021 one taken, when the proposed regulations are finalized and they come out, they might say something like, if you missed any RMDs since inheriting your IRA and the issuance of these final regulations, we're going to give you until X date to take those RMDs without any penalty and any need to file 5329 or something like that. Mm-hmm. I really think they will do that. They're not going to turn around and say, hey, you never took one in 2021, and we came out with these final regulations in 2023, so now we're going to hold you responsible. I don't see them doing that. However, 2022s, this year, if you want to be safe, if you want the best practice, take an RMD for 2022. Go ahead and do it, especially if you need the money. No harm, no foul. Take it from the inherited IRA. Or you can, I still think it would be just as defendable to not take it and wait for the proposed regulations, because I do feel, Chris, they will either exempt people who didn't take RMDs up until the final regulations, or tell people you will have a certain window to take them. Now, listener, if that means you might have to take a 2021, a 2022, and maybe a 2023 in the same year, and that's going to cause a tax nightmare, then you may want to proactively start taking her 2022 distribution this year. I think you're okay with the 2021. I don't see them going back and saying, Chris, you have to take all missed RMDs since the year you inherited it. I think they will say you have to take all missed RMDs from 2022, the year the proposed regulations came out, forward. So that's my thoughts. They could be as right or as wrong as anyone else's. What are your thoughts, Chris?
Well, as boring as it may sound, I'd love to create drama and disagree with you, but that's exactly how I see it. If 2021 turns out to be a year that they wanted you to take them and they end up passing it, becomes final rule, I can't think there's any way they could justify charging you a penalty for missing something they didn't tell you you needed to do back in the day. I could see them, I think the more likely one, if I had to place money bet on it, is that they will enact it and say, okay, from this date forward, this is how you need to behave. And there'll be a few years maybe where it was kind of a gap, and they just say, well, whatever you did then, If you didn't take them, then we're not coming after you. I think that's certainly possible. And then also, like you mentioned, hey, if you missed them because you didn't know you needed to take them, you've got until this date to do it. Which I also agree that if that's going to cause you a big problem, if that does happen, then maybe you do make some proactive steps here. Because you don't want them to say, oh, those 3, 4, 5 missed RMDs that you had, you've got to take them all out by the end of this year. And now you've piled up a bunch of distributions in one tax year that might be causing you a tax problem. So look at your situation. If that's going to be a threat, then maybe you be a little proactive, a little more proactive with this, even though they're not going to charge you a penalty per se. Just the act of them forcing it out at that rate might end up penalizing you in the form of a higher tax rate than you might otherwise pay. So look at that. And if that's a concern, then maybe be a little bit more proactive. But my guess is if that was the case, you've started to take money out over a period of time anyway. Because if you are facing a situation where if you were to take out a lot of the account balance within 1 year, you're not sitting there waiting for year 10 anyway, because you're going to cause yourself a major problem then. So I guess this is just another argument to do some tax strategies and tax planning and take a look at the situation and run some scenarios with the help of some tax software or a tax expert, tax professional, if you will, that'll look at some of these things for you and decide if you are facing some potential threats here before you just sit and wait. Because, I hate to let taxes happen to them rather than proactively planning for taxes, that's when they can get into some trouble.
Okay, perfect. This next question, first, I want to apologize. It's over a year old. I actually found it.
It must have slipped through.
Well, it was on, I'm recording from home, folks, and I do most of my recordings from home now. And it was on the desk here, which if anyone saw it, it's covered with papers. Anyways, I found it from June. It was marked basic planning question and interpretation. So I kind of read it and said, okay, this is going to be a basic and it's going to be up to, it's more of an art answer than a science answer. So I think you and I might be able to pick up on a few things here, especially you, Chris, because it's definitely a planning related question, but it also has some to do with investing. So let's get to it, folks. Let's read this. I apologize to this listener. It's over a year, but at least we're getting to it. So You got to look at it from that standpoint. He is from the fine state of Tennessee. He actually put in the subject podcast question from Tennessee. And then he put in parentheses, Kentucky is great, but Tennessee is better. So I know those are neighboring states. So that's his take. The Tennessee side of the border is better than the Kentucky side. I don't want to live that far south. As everyone knows, it'll either be in northern Kentucky right along the Ohio River or southern Ohio right along the Kentucky River. But way down there, it gets wicked humid in the summertime.
Yeah.
Okay, it begins. I will retire at the end of this year. Remember, this year, folks, is last year, 2021. I will retire at the end of this year at age 65. My wife will be 60 and was laid off last year due to COVID. We will turn on our Social Security and a small pension when I turn 70. Remember, he said, we will turn them. I'm under the impression the wife will turn hers on as well when he's 70. So I'm guessing she turns hers on at 65. That's my interpretation. He didn't say the wife is going to wait to 70. So I'm guessing both of them are going to be turning it on at the same time in about 5 years. Is that your interpretation as well?
Sounds like it so far.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then he goes on and he says, all total with our Social Security and pension, we will have $6,000 a month of secure income. This will more than cover our income floor. I'm thinking he's talking minimum dignity floor, folks, of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. So he's saying $6,000 a month, Chris, will more than cover his minimum dignity floor. Mm-hmm. So far, so good?
Yep.
Okay. We plan to use our cash reserves and assets in our portfolio over the next 5 years until age 70 to cover those living expenses. Mm-hmm. So what he's saying here, and Chris, let me know if you think I'm interpreting this wrong. He's going to use savings that they have, and I'll list his assets in a minute, everybody, and distributions from his retirement accounts to satisfy his minimum dignity floor expenses while they're in what Chris and I call the quote-unquote delay period. Mm-hmm. They're in that period of retirement where they're delaying their Social Security and pension, I guess, to maximize the benefits, which is a good thing. So during the first 5 years, while they're waiting for that lifetime secure income to rise to $6,000 or so a month, they're going to live off of their assets. Is that how you interpret it, Chris?
Yes.
Okay. We have funds in always taxable, maybe taxable, and never taxable accounts. These people must be regular listeners because he's picking up on all the verbiage that we use. For those who don't know, Chris and I call IRA and 401k assets always taxable. Why? Because for the most part, distributions are always taxable. We call money inside a bank or brokerage account, especially a brokerage account that's invested, maybe taxable because you may pay taxes on it. You may not. It can vary every single year because of the uniqueness of capital gain tax rules. And then we call never taxable assets Roth accounts, because again, if done correctly, qualified distributions from a Roth are tax-free. Okay. He says, my goal is to empty funds in my always taxable accounts over the next 5 years by doing Roth conversions. I would hope also he means spending some of the money that he needs to live on, unless he's thinking of taking those dollars from his maybe taxable accounts in a way that they won't be taxable, allowing him to do more conversions. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that part?
You know, I think this comes into where his goals are. If he's predicting that he's going to have a lot of money left over, and kids are involved, he's worried about taxes. Maybe he's got a goal of maximizing Roth size, which would tend to favor conversions. If he's got plenty of money in other accounts, bank accounts, etc., maybe he could pull off, you know, both of those situations, distributing for his own spending from there while doing a bunch of conversions. We'd kind of need to know a bit more to judge this. But yes, always remember, people, when you're trying to fill attractive tax brackets, whether you distribute for spending or you convert, that both of those do the same thing. They fill income tax brackets. So some, for most people, some combination of those are appropriate, unless your spending intent, I call it, drives enough withdrawals that it will fill all the tax brackets you ever wanted. So there just isn't any room to make attractive Roth conversions. That can sometimes happen with people as well. But you kind of got to look at the whole ball of wax there before determining what's appropriate.
Okay. But here's where it gets interesting, Chris. And I think here is where the art more than the science is going to step in of financial planning. You might get different planners disagreeing. I think Chris and I will agree on a lot of my observations, and I'm sure he's going to share his. It doesn't sound like much, but as I finished his closing paragraph, I started going, wait a minute, things may not quite be working out the way he thinks. So he continues. His goal, remember, Chris, is to empty his funds in his always taxable account. That would be his IRA, mm-hmm. as I'll share with you in a minute, mm-hmm. over the next 5 years. By the time I'm 70, we should have $500,000 in my maybe taxable and $500,000 in my never taxable Roth. That's it. $500,000 in brokerage, $500,000 in Roth. Our house is paid off. Then he jumps into his main question. What investment allocations would you recommend for those two accounts at that time? As if that's his big question, his big issue. But then he writes, Chris, we plan to self-fund our aging and long-term care needs. We also want to set aside $100,000 of our Roth as a guaranteed inheritance. And as I started thinking of all of this, one of the first things going through my mind was, I think he's, number one, and share with me because you do more of this than I do, I think he's over-converting. He's going to be wasting a lot of his tiny brackets, his 15% bracket in retirement. Now, I don't know what he's converting into, if he's going to get it all converted in 12 or 15. But I don't know if he needs to be doing all this conversions. But when he said he was going to self-fund his LTC and aging expenses, he didn't indicate if he's willing to use home equity. He never mentioned leaving the home to children, just that he wants to leave $100,000. If you stick to this, folks, he has $1 million at 70, $6,000 a year of income that he said will cover his basic living expenses. I don't think that means fun. I could be wrong, but if $6,000 a month covers his minimum dignity floor, and that is probably enough now, but I don't know if it's going to be enough at 80, 85, or 90. So I have a feeling there might be a minimum dignity floor shortage on this $6,000. I don't know. Maybe the cost of living in his part of Tennessee are very, very low. And his Social Security will be fine. But at the death of one of them, their Social Security is going to be cut. He shares with us, I didn't mention this, Chris, his Social Security is $3,400 at 70. His wife will be 16. His pension is only $1,000. So just keeping all dollars constant and not increasing them for inflation, he's going to lose about 40% of his guaranteed income. Or not him. Whoever dies first, the survivor is going to lose a good chunk of their guaranteed income, $1,600. But their minimum dignity floor will not drop by half. So there may be a shortage there as well. But if you're starting with $1 million, you're putting $100,000 off to the side as a guaranteed inheritance, you're down to $900,000. To adequately self-fund LTC, he may need to leave an additional $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, maybe more, depending on what their health situation is. So now this $900,000 could be as somewhere, oh, I don't know, $700,000 all the way down to maybe $400,000. Then if he doesn't mention at all, Chris, putting any additional dollars aside as a buffer. And I'm not convinced his $6,000 a month is going to cover his minimum dignity floor forever without putting a little bit more money aside. I guess my point is I wasn't sure if there was going to be a lot of dollars here, and I was trying to figure out where his fund spending was going to be. So those are some of the thoughts running through my head. As far as the investments go, we're not going to give advice on that, listener. What I'm going to encourage you to do is an exercise similar to what I just walked through. And that is look at your $1 million at age 70 that you're going to have and start trying to determine, do I need to put any aside for future minimum dignity floor needs? The guaranteed inheritance of $100,000 for your kids, you got to put that aside. Then your aging reserve that you want and long-term care reserve, that goes aside. Each of those little positions, we call them, you can call them a pie slice or any euphemism you want to give them. Each of those should be invested depending on their risk capacity. And the risk capacity will be based on when it's estimated in a worst case scenario, you would need those dollars. So maybe the guaranteed inheritance can be invested in 100% equities because you want to leave that to your child in a Roth. Your child, depending on the age you are when you die, can leave it for 10 years of additional tax-free growth. They may or may not have to take RMDs for the first 9 years, but they would be relatively small. So that could stay aggressively invested, but money that you might need for, say, aging-related expenses, you may want to invest those in a more moderately conservative manner, and any dollars that you may need for other spending needs that might occur immediately, you're going to need to keep those in principle protected. So I'm not going to tell you should invest it in a 60-40, 70-30, 80-20. I'm going to say you need to position it. But I am going to encourage you to listen to what Chris has to say, because I'm sure he's been thinking of this. I just don't know if you need to be doing conversions. And I don't know if you are going to have enough dollars to do everything you want to do, because I don't quite know where his fund spending is coming in. What are your thoughts?
Well, you used way too many words there, because you talked about practically everything. I'll say that first.
Well, that's why I wrote on it that it was more of a planning question and opinion type answer. So I just wanted to share that because you can wrap this all up with our listeners and then tell your thoughts about what this gentleman's case is, because I know you do this a lot more than I do. I don't do the planning part anymore for the last few years. Social Security.
Are you bailing out now?
Yeah, I'm going to say goodbye, folks, because I got to get ready and leave for the doctor's appointment. Mm-hmm. So Chris is going to give his thoughts and opinion mm-hmm. on this case and then his little Social Security questions that he has. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to say goodbye. That's why I went rambling on, because I wanted to get all my thoughts in before I left.
Okay, that sounds good. So I'll add a little bit to this. I think you covered a lot of what I'm thinking, but I'll wrap this up. Good luck at your appointment, and we'll see you next show.
All righty. Thanks a bunch, folks. Talk to you later.
Okay, bye. So in this particular case, first of all, let me back up to the idea that $6,000 a month would cover minimum dignity floor and actually maybe some fund spending. I think it's certainly possible in Tennessee if your spending is modest. I don't have all of this in front of me, so I'm going purely by memory. Since Jim's the one that had the printed email. But I do think it's possible that at 70, once they turn on all their Social Security and they've got the pension income, et cetera, they might be seeing in their projections that they're going to cover their minimum dignity floor and maybe a little bit more. However, it's likely that their minimum dignity floor expenses, which are dominated as you age by healthcare, which inflates at much higher rates than we've been seeing Social Security and pension income increase. And the pension may not increase at all. It's very common for pensions not to have a cost of living adjustment, that they may see what we call a crossover point later on. And so don't assume that if at 70, when it's turned on, everything looks good, that that's going to be the case indefinitely. You've got to take a look at the risk of inflation, which is always, been top of people's mind for the past 6 months or so, but it never should have been ignored. Inflation has always been part of the discussion when you're doing projections out 10, 15, 20, 30, maybe more years in a retirement planning scenario. You've got to take into consideration inflation. We don't know what it's going to be, but it's kind of been a persistent thing over time, and so you've got to make some kind of reasonable assumptions there. And I think it's likely if they were to apply some reasonable assumptions to inflation that they're going to find, they need to take part of their nest egg and commit it to covering minimum dignity floor expenses, either as the older couple or as the older single survivor when one of them passes away. I don't remember if I heard Jim mention anything about survivorship on the pension, but certainly the Social Security is going to drop. It's going to drop to just the $3,400. The $1,600 lower Social Security benefit is going to go away when the first of them passes. And I don't know what's going to happen with the pension. So look at the couple living to a ripe old age, and then look what happens if either of you pass, and determine if there's some of the extra money that you've got in these accounts needed just for that protection. That'd be my first comment. Secondly, I don't know for sure. Jim felt it was likely you were over converting, so putting too much into the Roth and away from always taxable by the time you were 70. Some people have that as a goal. They just like the idea of that, not being faced with the RMD issue anymore, because if you don't have traditional accounts, you don't have RMDs. Traditional retirement accounts, what we call always taxable, wouldn't face RMD situations if you didn't have those accounts. That can be a beautiful thing. But make sure that you're not going to put yourself into an abnormally low tax situation and then regret having paid so many taxes between 65 and 70. It might make sense, maybe not. We don't have enough information really to look at that. But that's the way we would encourage you to consider it. Make sure it's not likely you'll be in some really attractive rates later. But that's a lower concern than the other piece that Jim touched on and this listener mentioned, which was self-funding LTC and aging. I'm convinced there's a chunk of that money that they have outside of the secure income that's going to need to go to bolster the minimum dignity floor protection later on because of the inflationary pressures. Take that away. They don't have a whole lot of extra money to consider self-funding. And if you've got to fund a delay period and you've got to fund, fund spending, I don't know if maybe they've been talking this whole time about a complete overall budget that includes fun, but they didn't kind of break it out. If there's fund spending needed on top of some of these basics that they're talking about, there's not going to be a whole lot to go around for fun and leave a reserve that's sufficient enough to consider yourself self-funded, unless you're looking at it as we're going to self-fund a little bit, and then we just assume if things go poorly, we're going to go on Medicaid. We'll just be a Medicaid long-term care situation. If that's part of the plan, then you don't need a whole lot to self-fund if you're only planning to self-fund for a year or something. But if you're planning to just consider yourself protected and self-funded, that's a big number. That's a big number for a couple until you see, what happens. So I'd be concerned about that. I'd be concerned about all these things way before talking about asset allocation or portfolio design at age 70. We're big fans of here. I'm a huge fan of letting what the money needs to do for you determine how you invest it. And we've got a lot of figuring out to do. When I say we, that's the, you really, you're not clients of ours as a listener, and you need to be figuring out what this money needs to do for you. Once you determine that, then it will become pretty obvious how you can invest the money. Money needed long-term, maybe never for you. Hopefully it'll be inherited, but you plan never to touch it. That could be invested fairly aggressively because you don't need it in the near term. Money you need in the next 5 years, completely different story. Money that you need even in 8-10 years, completely different story than money that's set aside to go to kids or grandkids later on. So I know I've repeated a lot of what Jim said, and that's because we kind of have a consistent planning approach, which makes sense because we've worked together for a long time. But that's kind of how I would wrap it up. I think maybe the focus on what's important or the risk needs to be readdressed. I think I'd step back and look at minimum dignity floor and aging LTC issues before going into the portfolio design situation. So, okay. So let's do some Social Security now that we didn't do at the top of the show. We'll clean it up here at the bottom of the show. And let's start, let's see here. This one came in March of 2022. And it goes as follows. Hi, Jim and Chris. Call me George's mom from D.C. Love your show. I have what I think is a quick question about Social Security Survivor's Benefit, but it's been extremely hard to find an answer online, so I hoped you two could help. My husband died at 55 in 2017 when I was 50. His Social Security benefit statement from the year before he died listed his expected PIA at full retirement age as about $3,200. My question is, will that always be the number that the initial survivor's benefit will be determined from? Or are there any COLA adjustments to that PIA before benefits begin? Most of the online information about survivor benefits are based on one or the other of the spouses having already started or qualified for their benefits, and not in my case of both of us being well below that age. Then they talk about something unrelated here. So this is a great question, and I agree it's not readily talked about or not frequently talked about online when you search for it. I Googled around to see if someone were looking for this question, what they'd find, and I can totally understand that they're confused because there isn't a whole lot that talks about this specific situation. But the answer, luckily, is quite straightforward, and you will, in fact, see cost of living adjustments that have happened since your husband's passing applied to that PIA number of his to make that initial determination. From that adjusted amount, where they do include then the cost of living adjustments since his death, you and your claiming age might reduce that by claiming early. What I mean by that is even though you can claim survivor benefits as young as age 60 or as young as age 50 if you're disabled, they will be reduced at 60. And instead, if you wait until your own full retirement age for survivor benefits, you will get 100% of the adjusted PIA that you were referencing, adjusted by the cost of living adjustments that have happened since your husband's passing. So the simple answer is yes, they'll adjust it. You're not going to miss out on all of those. This is actually a common misunderstanding about Social Security cost of living adjustments, not just for survivor benefits, but for other benefits. People are constantly worried that if they're not claiming, are they missing out on all these adjustments? And like last year, that was 5.9%. When I say last year, it's what's been applied for this year's benefit in 2022. But at the end of 2021, they determined 5.9% increase, biggest increase in a very, very long time. This year, 22 into 23, looks like it's going to be even much higher than that because of the inflation that we're seeing. There's a lot of talk that we're talking about 9% maybe on the cost of living adjustments for the next year. And if you haven't claimed, you might be thinking, oh my gosh, I'm waiting to claim so I can get a bigger amount later, but I'm giving up these cost of living adjustments. And that's not the case. That is not true. Once you become, a certain benefit is defined, for the most part, with a couple of rare exceptions, you're going to get constant cost of living adjustments applied moving forward. So don't fret, you'll get those adjustments. So that is, you suspected it was a fairly simple question, and it's a pretty simple answer, but the case is not described a whole lot on the internet. So next question here is even shorter as I see it, but I read this one ahead of time because Jim emailed it to me right as we started the show, and this actually opens the door to something I've been meaning to talk about. So let me get into the question then, and we'll go the direction I really want to take this, which this came in February of this year. Hi, Jim and Chris. Love the show. Every time I've heard the 5.9% Social Security inflationary adjustment for 2022 being discussed, it's always been in the context of the increase for current Social Security claimants. So this is very similar to the last question. It's, you know, gee, if I'm not claiming yet, do I get these? And he continues, as someone who's 60 years old and waiting to claim Social Security benefits at 70, do my projected benefits also get increased for these adjustments that occur prior to claiming? I'd appreciate hearing you and Chris address this on a future show. Thanks. Buckeye George, so must be from Ohio. Similar question to the last one, just pertaining to their own benefit. I'm waiting to claim. Am I getting any of these big, sweet cost of living adjustments? He references the 5.9% from this past year. Upcoming, it's going to almost for sure be bigger than that going into 2023. And you're waiting on the sidelines, kind of lamenting that you seem to not be getting them. For the most part, you're going to get them. But this actually opens the door to a weird situation where there's some people who are not going to get the benefit of these years of really high cost of living adjustments. And let me explain why. When your official primary insurance amount, the PIA, or the amount that you're going to collect at your full retirement age, is determined. There's estimates all the way up until the year you turn 62. When you turn 62, they look back and assess your earnings record, and they adjust all of your previous earnings for wage inflation, not price inflation, but for wage inflation. And they apply those adjustments, or index is what they call it, your earnings from the past years, applying wage inflation from those years when you had the earnings all the way up until age 60. And remember I said age 62 is when they do that. Why 62? Because 62 is the first year that you can claim a retirement benefit. And so that's the year they officially determine your PIA. Well, because of the delay in having data to do these calculations, they don't give you wage inflation for the years you turn 60 and 61. Those earnings from those years get entered into your earnings record at face value. There's no wage inflation indexing applied to your earnings record after you turn 60. There's also no cost of living adjustments applied to your benefit until you are eligible to receive benefits in age 62. So if you're paying attention here, there's a gap between 60 and 62 where you're neither getting wage inflation nor are you getting cost of living adjustments applied to your PIA and thus your benefit. So I've been thinking about those poor souls who are in that little gap as these big cost of living adjustments are happening. Let's say you're 61 right now, and there's a big cost of living adjustment announced of 9%. Well, that's not going to help you. It's not going to help you. There's a slight adjustment. People might say, well, gee, wait a minute. There's that, you know, they can't just completely ignore it. There are adjustments to the bend points for determining your benefit based on your AMI, your average index monthly earnings. And by increasing the size of those bend points, those are the amounts of your average indexed monthly earnings that are replaced at the 90% level, the 32% level, the 15% level, etc. So there's some benefit there as those bend points end up increasing, but you're kind of in this donut hole, if you will, for people who are 60, 61 during this time period where these big inflationary numbers are coming in. You're kind of missing those. If they continue moving forward, then you'll pick up and receive those. But there's this weird window that kind of moves forward in time as people that were born in 1960, 61, 62, 63, etc. The window of that two-year gap where you're getting neither a wage increase affecting your earnings nor a cost of living increase affecting the benefit, you miss both. So everyone's going to have to look at their own situation and see how much it's going to affect you, but there is this potential. We talked last year and before, there was all this, you know, hullabaloo on the internet as they were talking about, oh, people born in 1960, because 2020 was such a bad year, that's the last year that you're going to get benefit of wage inflation applied, and if wages go down that year, in 2020, average wage index is going to go down, was the expectation. So there's going to be permanent harm done to your benefit. And that was hitting all the headlines. People were freaked out about it. Turned out, as we announced on this show, and you've seen other places or read other places, turns out 2020 didn't have that big drop in average wage index. There's actually a slight increase, I believe, or it was a very minor decrease. That whole threat of, oh my gosh, the wage index is going to plummet for that year and permanently harm those born in 1960. There's been not a peep about people born in 1961 and 1962, 1963 in this range that might be missing out on these cost of living adjustments and wage inflation pieces that would otherwise have bumped their benefit up significantly for the rest of their life. They're missing those. and I haven't heard a peep about it. I don't know why. People were so concerned about something that even initially I said, you know, I'm not that concerned. Let's see how things go. Not that I could tell the future, but it turned out that, you know, I was convinced if it was truly a permanent harm that Congress might step in and provide relief for those poor souls born in 1960. Turned out there wasn't major harm. There wasn't this big harm that happened to them. But this is an issue that isn't new. It's not new. It just is bad timing. It's just coincidence, kind of like the 1960 issue was a coincidence for those people, turned out not to harm them. But that was the worry, that just through the timing and the way the calculations are made, the timing of the wage decrease that was expected in 2020 was going to really harm them. Well, this is really happening. We saw the 5.9% last year. We're going to see like a 9% this year. If you're not getting that because you don't turn 62 until next year, so you turn 61 this year, you're not getting the wage inflation for 2022 factored in. You're not getting the COLA for 2022 factored in. You're in that no man's land between age 60 and 62 where you're getting neither. So be aware of that. You're not going to see a reduction in your anticipated benefit, but you're not going to see the hike that you otherwise would get if they credited you with the cost of living adjustment. But if you go look at the rules and the way they do it, they don't give you those cost of living adjustments until after you've turned 62. So just wanted to bring that up. And this question kind of relates to that because he's talking about, he was talking about something he was concerned about. Unfortunately, I just threw gasoline on that fire. He's got a bigger issue to be concerned about. Not that there's a solution. He can't undo it. There's no getting around it unless they change the rules and change how the calculation is made or give some kind of one-time bonus or something. I don't think they're going to do that. But this has been something I've been meaning to bring up, and I didn't have the right question, and this is it. This was the question that seems so innocent, but allowed me to talk about what I think is something that the sensational bloggers and media that look for things to put in the headlines that's all exciting and concerning, they attack the wrong thing. The being born in 1960 and having a permanent reduction, that was a non-story, turns out. This is happening. This is actually happening. We're seeing it happen. The 5.9% from last year, the what might be up to 9% cost of living this year, because of timing, you miss both of those. That's real harm compared to what, you know, your neighbors that are a slightly different age are experiencing. So just throwing it out there. If anybody's heard that anywhere else, I'd love to hear where, because hopefully I'm not the only one, and hopefully I'm not wrong in my understanding of this. But I've been doing this for quite a while, and I don't see any reason why I shouldn't be coming to this conclusion. If someone has a good reason to disagree with me, let me know, and I'd be happy to look into it some more. But on that on that happy note, sorry to depress people right at the end of the show. That's what we've got. A couple Social Security questions at the end here. Thanks for sticking with us. If you've got questions, Social Security or otherwise, send them in to us. You can send them directly to Jim. Jim@jimhelps.com is one way to send them in. Make sure in the subject line you put that it is a podcast question. Or you can go to our website, jimhelps.com, and fill in the contact form there or submit a podcast question through that form. I think the email is where Jim watches for most of them, so just sending them directly to him is probably the best. And can't make the show go without your questions, so keep sending them in. We'll get to them as soon as we can. And even though a lot of these we answer from months previous, we always do a fresh new question that we just received recently. So you might luck out and get chosen as the hot new question of the week. And thanks again for listening. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.